The Power of Habit. Having myself experienced all the difficulties that stand in the road of those who lack the understanding to make practical application of this great principle of autosuggestion, let me take you a short way into the principle of habit through the aid of which you may easily apply the principle of autosuggestion in any direction and for any purpose whatsoever. Habit grows out of environment, out of doing the same thing or thinking the same thoughts or repeating the same words over and over again. Habit may be likened to the groove on a record, while the human mind may be likened to the needle that fits into that groove. When any habit has been well formed through repetition of thought or action, the mind has a tendency to attach itself to and follow the course of that habit as closely as the phonograph needle follows the groove in the record. Habit is created by repeatedly directing one or more of the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling in a given direction. After habit has been well established, it will automatically control and direct our bodily activity, wherein may be found a thought that can be transformed into a powerful factor in the development of self-confidence. The thought is this: voluntarily and by force, if necessary, direct your efforts and your thoughts along a desired line until you have formed the habit that will lay hold of you and continue voluntarily to direct your efforts along the same line. The object in writing out and repeating the self-confidence formula is to form the habit of making belief in yourself the dominating thought of your mind until that thought has been thoroughly embedded in your subconscious mind through the principle of habit. You learned to write by repeatedly directing the muscles of your arm and hand over certain outlines known as letters until finally you formed the habit of tracing these outlines. Now you write with ease and rapidity without tracing each letter slowly. Writing has become a habit with you. The principle of habit will lay hold of the faculties of your mind just the same as it will influence the physical muscles of your body, as you can easily prove by mastering and applying this lesson on self-confidence. Any statement that you repeatedly make to yourself, or any desire that you deeply plant in your mind through repeated statement, will eventually seek expression through your physical, outward, bodily efforts. The principle of habit is the very foundation upon which this lesson on self-confidence is built. And if you will understand and follow the directions laid down in this lesson, you will soon know more about the law of habit from first-hand knowledge than could be taught you by 1,000 such lessons as this. You have but little conception of the possibilities which lie sleeping within you, awaiting but the awakening hand of vision to arouse you. And you will never have a better conception of those possibilities unless you develop sufficient self-confidence to lift you above the commonplace influences of your present environment.
You can always become the person you would have liked to be.
The human mind is a marvelous, mysterious piece of machinery, a fact of which I was reminded a few months ago when I picked up Emerson's essays and reread his essay on spiritual laws. A strange thing happened. I saw in that essay, which I had read scores of times previously, much that I had never noticed before. I saw more in this essay than I had seen during previous readings because the unfoldment of my mind since the last reading had prepared me to interpret more. The human mind is constantly unfolding, like the petals of a flower, until it reaches the maximum of development. What this maximum is, where it ends, or whether it ends at all or not, are unanswerable questions, but the degree of unfoldment seems to vary according to the nature of the individual and the degree to which you keep your mind at work. A mind that is forced or coaxed into analytical thought every day seems to keep on unfolding and developing greater powers of interpretation. Down in Louisville, Kentucky, lives Mr. Lee Cook, a man who has practically no legs and has to wheel himself around on a cart. In spite of the fact that Mr. Cook has been without legs since birth, he is the owner of a great industry and a millionaire through his own efforts. He has proved that people can get along very well without legs if they have a well-developed self-confidence. In the city of New York, one may see a strong, able-bodied, and able-headed young man without legs rolling himself down Fifth Avenue every afternoon, with cap in hand, begging for a living. His head is perhaps as sound and as able to think as the average. This young man could duplicate anything that Mr. Cook of Louisville has done if he thought of himself as Mr. Cook thinks of himself. Henry Ford owns more millions of dollars than he will ever need or use. Not so many years ago, he was working as a laborer in a machine shop with but little schooling and without capital. Scores of other men, some of them with better organized brains than his, worked near him. Ford threw off the poverty consciousness, developed confidence in himself, thought of success, and attained it. Those who worked around him could have done as well as he, had they thought as he did. Milo C. Jones of Wisconsin was stricken down with paralysis a few years ago. So bad was the stroke that he could not turn himself in bed or move a muscle of his body. His physical body was useless, but there was nothing wrong with his brain. So it began to function in earnest, probably for the first time in its existence. Lying flat on his back in bed, Mr. Jones made that brain create a definite purpose. That purpose was prosaic and humble enough in nature, but it was definite, and it was a purpose, something that he had never known before. His definite purpose was to make pork sausage. Calling his family around him, he told of his plans and began directing them in carrying the plans into action. With nothing to aid him except a sound mind and plenty of self-confidence, Milo C. Jones spread the name and reputation of Little Pig Sausage all over the United States, and accumulated a fortune besides. All this was accomplished after paralysis had made it impossible for him to work with his hands.
Many more modern examples can also be cited. There is a powerful disease called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. It affects the nerves that control the muscles, causing them to waste away, bringing paralysis and usually death in just a few short years. This condition afflicts the famous physicist, Dr. Stephen Hawking, and has for more than two decades. Dr. Hawking's body is severely limited, but his mind is not. He has taken his mind down incredible roads where he explores the secrets of the universe, studying black holes, quantum physics, even the very nature of time. Dr. Hawking's mind has unfolded to a previously unimagined degree because he made it his habit to develop it. Peter Leonard seemed to have been dealt a tough hand in life. He had learning disabilities that gave him a very hard time with reading and writing. By the time he reached middle age, he was divorced and unemployed. But he conceived an idea that came to dominate his mind. He wanted to serve in the New Hampshire legislature. He lost his first campaign and his second. Others would have given up, but Leonard looked at himself and realized that his best chances lay in his own efforts, despite the fact that he had no experience and less money. So, for his next campaign, he began going door to door in his district. He met everyone he could, he walked in parades, attended community meetings. He spent just $12 on some posters and $36 on filing fees, and that was the extent of his spending. And Peter Leonard was elected. His path was unusual, but he found it by making a habit of working toward being elected. Where thought prevails, power may be found.
Where thought prevails, power may be found. Henry Ford has made millions of dollars and is still making millions of dollars each year because he believed in Henry Ford and transformed that belief into a definite purpose, and backed that purpose with a definite plan. The other machinists who worked along with Ford during the early days of his career visioned nothing but a weekly pay envelope, and that was all they ever got. They demanded nothing out of the ordinary of themselves. If you want to get more, be sure to demand more of yourself. Notice that this demand is to be made on yourself. There comes to mind a well-known poem whose author expressed a great psychological truth. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you like to win but you think you can't, it is almost certain you won't. If you think you'll lose, you've lost. For out of the world we find success begins with a fellow's will. It's all in the state of mind. If you think you are outclassed, you are. You've got to think high to rise. You've got to be sure of yourself before you can ever win a prize. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man, but soon or late the man who wins is the man who thinks he can. It can do no harm if you commit this poem to memory and use it as a part of your working equipment in the development of self-confidence. Somewhere in your makeup there is a subtle something which, if it were aroused by the proper outside influence, would carry you to heights of achievement such as you have never before anticipated. Just as a master player can take hold of a violin and cause that instrument to pour forth the most beautiful and entrancing strains of music, so is there some outside influence that can lay hold of your mind and cause you to go forth into the field of your chosen endeavor and play a glorious symphony of success. No one knows what hidden forces lie dormant within you. You yourself do not know your capacity for achievement, and you will never know until you come in contact with that particular stimulus which arouses you to greater action and extends your vision, develops your self-confidence, and moves you with a deeper desire to achieve. It is not unreasonable to expect that some statement, some idea, or some stimulating word of this course on the law of success will serve as the needed stimulus that will reshape your destiny and redirect your thoughts and energies along a pathway that will lead you, finally, to your coveted goal of life.
Theodore Roosevelt wrote, "The only man who makes no mistakes is the man who never does anything. Do not be afraid of mistakes, providing you do not make the same one twice."
It is strange but true that the most important turning points of life often come at the most unexpected times and in the most unexpected ways. I have in mind a typical example of how some of the seemingly unimportant experiences of life often turn out to be the most important of all. And I am relating this case because it shows also what a person can accomplish when he or she awakens to a full understanding of the value of self-confidence. The incident to which I refer happened in the city of Chicago, while I was engaged in the work of character analysis. One day a tramp presented himself at my office and asked for an interview. As I looked up from my work and greeted him, he said, "I have come to see the man who wrote this little book." As he removed from his pocket a copy of a book entitled Self-Confidence, which I had written many years previously. "It must have been the hand of fate," he continued, "that slipped this book into my pocket yesterday afternoon, because I was about ready to go out there and punch a hole in Lake Michigan. I had about come to the conclusion that everything and everybody, including God, had it in for me until I read this book, and it gave me a new viewpoint and brought me the courage and the hope that sustained me through the night. I made up my mind that if I could see the man who wrote this book, he could help me get on my feet again. Now I am here, and I would like to know what you can do for a man like me." While he was speaking, I had been studying him from head to foot, and I am frank to admit that down deep in my heart I did not believe there was anything that I could do for him, but I did not wish to tell him so. The glassy stare in his eyes, the lines of discouragement in his face, the posture of his body, the 10 days' growth of beard on his face, the nervous manner about this man all conveyed to me the impression that he was hopeless, but I did not have the heart to tell him so. Therefore I asked him to sit down and tell me his whole story. I asked him to be perfectly frank and tell me as nearly as possible just what had brought him down to the ragged edge of life. I promised him that after I had heard his entire story I would then tell him whether or not I could be of service to him. He related his story in lengthy detail, the sum and substance of which was this. He had invested his entire fortune in a small manufacturing business. When the World War began in 1914, it was impossible for him to get the raw materials necessary for the operation of his factory, and he therefore failed. The loss of his money broke his heart and so disturbed his mind that he left his wife and children and became a tramp. He had actually brooded over his loss until he had reached the point at which he was contemplating suicide. After he had finished his story, I said to him, "I have listened to you with a great deal of interest, and I wish that there was something that I could do to help you. But there is absolutely nothing." He became as pale as he will be when he is laid away in a coffin and settled back in his chair and dropped his chin on his chest as much as to say, "That settles it." I waited for a few seconds, then said, "While there is nothing that I can do for you, there is a man in this building to whom I will introduce you, if you wish, who can help you regain your lost fortune and put you back on your feet again." These words had barely fallen from my lips when he jumped up, grabbed me by the hands and said, "For God's sake, lead me to this man." It was encouraging to note that he had asked this for God's sake. This indicated that there was still a spark of hope within his breast. So I took him by the arm and led him out into the laboratory where my psychological tests and character analysis were conducted, and stood with him in front of what looked to be a curtain over a door. I pulled the curtain aside and uncovered a tall mirror in which he saw himself from head to foot. Pointing my finger at the glass, I said, "There stands the man to whom I promised to introduce you. There is the only man in this world who can put you back on your feet again. And unless you sit down and become acquainted with that man as you never became acquainted with him before, you might just as well go on over and punch a hole in Lake Michigan, because you will be of no value to yourself or to the world until you know this man better." He stepped over to the glass, rubbed his hands over his bearded face, studied himself from head to foot for a few moments, then stepped back, dropped his head, and began to weep. I knew that the lesson had been driven home, so I led him back to the elevator and sent him away. I never expected to see him again, and I doubted that the lesson would be sufficient to help him regain his place in the world, because he seemed to be too far gone for redemption. He seemed to be not only down, but almost out. A few days later, I met this man on the street. His transformation had been so complete that I hardly recognized him. He was walking briskly, with his head tilted back. That old, shifting, nervous posture of his body was gone. He was dressed in new clothes from head to foot. He looked prosperous, and he felt prosperous. He stopped me and related what had happened to bring about his rapid transformation from a state of abject failure to one of hope and promise. "I was just on my way to your office," he explained, "to bring you the good news. I went out the very day that I was in your office, a down-and-out tramp, and despite my appearance, I sold myself at a salary of $3,000 a year. Think of it, man! $3,000 a year. And my employer advanced me money enough to buy some new clothes, as you can see for yourself. He also advanced me some money to send home to my family, and I am once more on the road to success. It seems like a dream when I think that only a few days ago I had lost hope and faith and courage and was actually contemplating suicide. I was coming to tell you that one of these days, when you are least expecting me, I will pay you another visit. And when I do, I will be a successful man. I will bring with me a check signed in blank and made payable to you, and you may fill in the amount because you have saved me from myself by introducing me to myself. That self which I never knew, until you stood me in front of that mirror and pointed out the real me." As that man turned and departed in the crowded streets of Chicago, I saw for the first time in my life what strength and power and possibility lie hidden in the mind of the man who has never discovered the value of self-reliance. Then and there I made up my mind that I too would stand in front of that same looking glass and point an accusing finger at myself for not having discovered the lesson which I had helped another to learn. I did stand before that same looking glass, and as I did so, I then and there fixed in my mind as my definite purpose in life the determination to help men and women discover the forces that lie sleeping within them. This program you're hearing is evidence that my definite purpose is being carried out. The man whose story I have related is now the president of one of the largest and most successful concerns of its kind in America, with a business that extends from coast to coast and from Canada to Mexico. A short while after the incident just related, a woman came to my office for personal analysis. She was then a teacher in the Chicago Public Schools. I gave her an analysis chart and asked her to fill it out. She had been at work on the chart but a few minutes when she came back to my desk, handed back the chart, and said, "I do not believe I will fill this out." I asked her why she had decided not to fill out the chart, and she replied, "To be perfectly frank with you, one of the questions in this chart put me to thinking, and I now know what is wrong with me. Therefore, I feel it unnecessary to pay you a fee to analyze me." With that, the woman went away, and I did not hear from her for 2 years. She went to New York City, became a writer of advertising copy from one of the largest agencies in the country, and her income at the time she wrote me was $10,000 a year. This woman sent me a check to cover the cost of my analysis fee because she felt that the fee had been earned, even though I did not render her the service that I usually render my clients. It is impossible for anyone to foretell what seemingly insignificant incident may lead to an important turning point in one's career. But there is no denying the fact that these turning points may be more readily recognized by those who have well-rounded out confidence in themselves.
Love, beauty, joy, and worship are forever building, tearing down, and rebuilding the foundation of each man's soul.
One of the irreparable losses to the human race lies in the lack of knowledge that there is a definite method through which self-confidence can be developed in any person of average intelligence. What an immeasurable loss to civilization that young men and women are not taught this known method of developing self-confidence before they complete their schooling. For no one who lacks faith in himself is really educated in the proper sense of the term. Oh, what glory and satisfaction would be the happy heritage of the man or woman who could pull aside the curtain of fear that hangs over the human race and shuts out the sunlight of understanding that self-confidence brings wherever it is in evidence. Where fear controls, noteworthy achievement becomes an impossibility, a fact which brings to mind the definition of fear as stated by a great philosopher. Fear is the dungeon of the mind into which it runs and hides and seeks seclusion. Fear brings on superstition, and superstition is the dagger with which hypocrisy assassinates the soul. In front of the typewriter on which I am writing the manuscripts for this course hangs a sign with the following wording, in big letters. Day by day, in every way, I am becoming more successful. A skeptic who read that sign asked if I really believed that stuff, and I replied, "Of course not. All it ever did for me was to help me get out of the coal mines where I started as a laborer and find a place in the world in which I am serving upwards of 100,000 people, in whose minds I am planting the same positive thought that this sign brings out. Therefore, why should I believe in it?" As this man started to leave, he said, "Well, perhaps there is something to this sort of philosophy after all, for I have always been afraid that I would be a failure, and so far my fears have been thoroughly realized." You are condemning yourself to poverty, misery, and failure, or you are driving yourself on toward the heights of great achievement solely by the thoughts you think. If you demand success of yourself and back up this demand with intelligent action, you are sure to win. Bear in mind, though, that there is a difference between demanding success and just merely wishing for it. You should find out what this difference is and take advantage of it. Do you remember what the Bible says about those who have faith as a grain of mustard seed? Look it up in the book of Matthew, chapter 13. Go at the task of developing self-confidence with at least that much faith, if not more. Never mind what they will say, because you might as well know that they will be of little aid to you in your climb up the mountainside of life toward the object of your definite purpose. You have within you all the power you need with which to get whatever you want or need in this world, and about the best way to avail yourself of this power is to believe in yourself. Know thyself, man. Know thyself. This has been the advice of the philosophers all down the ages. When you really know yourself, you will know that there is nothing foolish about hanging a sign in front of you that reads like this: "Day by day, in every way, I am becoming more successful." With due apologies to Emile Coué, who made this motto popular. I am not afraid to place this sort of suggestion in front of my desk, and what is more to the point, I am not afraid to believe that it will influence me so that I will become a more positive and aggressive human being. More than 25 years ago, I learned my first lesson in self-confidence building. One night, I was sitting before an open fireplace, listening to a conversation between some older men on the subject of capital and labor. Without invitation, I joined in the conversation and said something about employers and employees settling their differences on the golden rule basis. My remarks attracted the attention of one of the men, who turned to me with a look of surprise on his face and said, "Why, you are a bright boy, and if you would go out and get a schooling, you would make your mark in the world." These remarks fell on fertile ears, even though that was the first time anyone had ever told me that I was bright or that I might accomplish anything worthwhile in life. The remark put me to thinking. and the more I allowed my mind to dwell upon that thought, the more certain I became that the remark had back of it a possibility. It might be truthfully stated that whatever service I am rendering the world and whatever good I accomplish should be credited to that offhand remark. Suggestions such as this are often powerful, and nonetheless so when they are deliberate and self-expressed. Go back now to the self-confidence formula and master it, for it will lead you into the powerhouse of your own mind, where you will tap a force that can be made to carry you to the very top of the ladder of success. Others will believe in you only when you believe in yourself. They will tune in on your thoughts and feel toward you just as you feel toward yourself. The law of mental telepathy takes care of this. You are continuously broadcasting what you think of yourself, and if you have no faith in yourself, others will pick up the vibration of your thoughts and mistake them for their own. Once understand the law of mental telepathy, and you will know why self-confidence is the third of the 17 laws of success. You should be cautioned, however, to learn the difference between self-confidence, which is based upon sound knowledge of what you know and what you can do, and egotism, which is only based upon what you wish you knew or could do. Learn the difference between these two terms, or you will make yourself boring, ridiculous, and annoying to people of culture and understanding. Self-confidence is something that should never be proclaimed or announced except through intelligent performance of constructive deeds. If you have self-confidence, those around you will discover this fact. Let them make the discovery. They will feel proud of their alertness in having made the discovery, and you will be free from the suspicion of egotism. Opportunity never stalks the person with a highly developed state of egotism, but brickbats and ugly remarks do. Opportunity forms affinities much more easily and quickly with self-confidence than it does with egotism. Self-praise is never a proper measure of self-reliance. Bear this in mind and let your self-confidence speak only through the tongue of constructive service rendered without fuss or flurry. Self-confidence is the product of knowledge. Know yourself. Know how much you know and how little. Why you know it and how you are going to use it. Four-flushers come to grief. Therefore, do not pretend to know more than you actually do know. There's no use of pretense because any educated person will measure you quite accurately after hearing you speak for 3 minutes. What you really are will speak so loudly that what you claim you are will not be heard. If you heed this warning, the latter part of this one lesson may mark one of the most important turning points of your life. Believe in yourself, but do not tell the world what you can do. Show it. Discontentment, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. The marker stands at the entrance gate of life and writes "poor fool" on the brow of the wise man and "poor sinner" on the brow of the saint. The supreme mystery of the universe is life. We come here without our consent from whence we know not. We go away without our consent whither we know not. We are eternally trying to solve this great riddle of life. And for what purpose and to what end? That we are placed on this earth for a definite reason, there can be no doubt by any thinker. May it not be possible that the power that placed us here will know what to do with us when we pass on beyond the great divide? Would it not be a good plan to give the Creator who placed us here on earth credit for having enough intelligence to know what to do with us after we pass on? Or should we assume the intelligence and the ability to control the future life in our own way? May it not be possible that we can cooperate with the Creator very intelligently by assuming to control our conduct on this earth, to the end that we may be decent to one another and do all the good we can in all the ways we can during this life, leaving the hereafter to one who probably knows better than we what is best for us? From birth until death, the mind is always reaching out for that which it does not possess. The little child playing with its toys on the floor sees another child with a different sort of toy and immediately tries to lay hands on that toy. Adults continue to pursue what they perceive as bigger, better, and more toys, the more the better. F.W. Woolworth, the 5- and 10-cent store's king, stood on Fifth Avenue in New York City and gazed upward at the tall Metropolitan Building and said, "How wonderful! I will build one much taller." The crowning achievement of his life was measured by the Woolworth Building, That building stands as a temporary symbol of man's nature to excel the handiwork of other men. A monument to the vanity of man, with but little else to justify its existence. The little ragged newsboy on the street stands with wide open mouth and envies the businessman as he alights from his automobile at the curb and starts into his office. How happy I would be, the newsboy says to himself, if I owned a car like that. And the businessman, seated at his desk inside, thinks how happy he would be if he could add another $1 million to his already overswollen bankroll. The grass is always sweeter on the other side of the fence, says the jackass as he stretches his neck in the attempt to get to it. Turn a crowd of boys into an apple orchard and they will pass by the nice mellow apples on the ground. The red juicy ones hanging dangerously high in the top of the tree look much more tempting, and up the tree they will go. The married man takes a sheepish glance at the ladies on the street and thinks how fortunate he would be if his wife were as pretty as they. Perhaps she is much prettier, but he misses that beauty because, well, because the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Happiness is always just around the bend, always in sight, but just out of reach. Life is never complete, no matter what we have or how much of it we possess. One thing calls for something else to go with it. You long for a home, just a plain little house sitting off in the edge of the woods. You build it, but it is not complete. You must have shrubbery and flowers and landscaping to go with it. Still, it is not complete. You must have a beautiful fence around it, with a graveled driveway. That calls for a second car and a garage. All these little touches have been added, but to no avail. The place is now too small. You must have a house with more rooms. The Ford must be replaced by a Cadillac. On and on the story goes, ad infinitum. You receive a salary sufficient to keep yourself and your family fairly comfortable. Then comes a promotion and an advance in salary of $1,000 a year. Do you lay the extra $1,000 away in the savings account and continue living as before? You do nothing of the sort. Immediately, you must trade in the old car for a new one. A porch must be added to the house. Someone needs a new wardrobe. The table must be set with better food. At the end of the year, are you better off with such an increase? Nothing of the sort. The more you get, the more you want, and the rule applies to the millionaire as much as it does to someone with only a few thousand. A young man selects the girl of his choice, believing he cannot live without her. After he gets her, he is not sure that he can live with her. If a man remains a bachelor, he wonders why he is so stupid as to deprive himself of the joys of married life. If he marries, he wonders how she happened to catch him off guard long enough to harpoon him. And the god of destiny cries out, "Oh fool, oh fool, you are damned if you do, and you are damned if you don't." At every crossroad of life, the imps of discontentment stand in the shadows of the background with a grin of mockery on their faces, crying out, "Take the road of your own choice. We will get you in the end." At last, many become disillusioned and begin to learn that happiness and contentment are not of this world. Then begins the search for the password that will open the door to some world of which we know nothing. Surely there must be happiness on the other side of the great divide. In desperation, his tired, careworn heart turns to religion for hope and encouragement. But his troubles are not over. They are just starting. In the midst of sectarian claims and counterclaims, we become undecided. Not knowing whether to turn this way or that, we wonder which brand of religion offers the safest passageway until hope vanishes. As expressed in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam in the Fitzgerald translation, "Myself, when young, did eagerly frequent doctor and saint, and heard great argument about it and about, but evermore came out by the same door wherein I went." Always seeking, but never finding. This might describe the human struggle for happiness and contentment. We try one religion after another, finally joining the big church which the world has named the damned. Our minds become eternal question marks, searching hither and yon for an answer to the questions whence and whither. Again from the Rubaiyat, "The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two, is gone." Life is an everlasting question mark. That which we want most is always in the embryonic distance of the future. Our power to acquire is always a decade or so behind our power to desire. And if we catch up with the thing we want, we no longer want it. Our favorite author is a hero and a genius until we meet him in person and learn the sad truth that, after all, he is only human. As Emerson wrote, "How often must we learn this lesson? People cease to interest us when we find their limitations. The only sin is limitation. As soon as you once come up with a man's limitations, it is all over with him." Unquote. How beautiful the mountain yonder in the distance. But the moment we draw near it, we find it to be nothing but a wretched collection of rocks and dirt and trees. Out of this truth grew the oft-repeated adage, "Familiarity breeds contempt." Beauty and happiness and contentment are states of mind. They can never be enjoyed except through vision of the afar. The most beautiful painting of Rembrandt becomes a mere smudge of daubed paint if we come too near it. Destroy the hope of unfinished dreams in a person's heart, and he or she is finished. The moment we cease to cherish the vision of future achievement, we are through. Nature has built us so that our greatest and only lasting happiness is that which we feel in the pursuit of some yet unattained object. Anticipation is sweeter than realization. That which is at hand does not satisfy. The only enduring satisfaction is that which comes to the person who keeps alive in his heart the hope of future achievement. When that hope dies, write "fini" across the human heart. Life's greatest inconsistency is the fact that most of that which we believe is not true. Russell Conwell wrote an extremely popular lecture called Acres of Diamonds. The central idea of the lecture was the statement that one need not seek opportunity in the distance, that opportunity may be found in the vicinity of one's birth. Perhaps, but how many believe it? Opportunity may be found wherever one really looks for it, and nowhere else. To most of us, the picking looks better on the other side of the fence. How futile to urge one to try out one's luck in the little hometown when it is human nature to look for opportunity in some other locality. Do not worry because the grass looks sweeter on the other side of the fence. Nature intended it so. Thus does she allure us and groom us for the lifelong task of growth through struggle. Some modern miracles. Some people doubt the authenticity of the Bible, because they believe that if miracles could be performed over 2,000 years ago, before the dawn of science, while the world was still steeped in illiteracy and superstition, it should be just as easy to perform them today. I have read the Bible very carefully, some parts of it many times. I am convinced that it contains no account of any alleged miracle that has not been more than matched in our times in the open light of science. Moreover, these modern-day miracles are subject to analysis and proof. Any child of average intelligence above the age of 12 years may understand the miracles of today, and for this reason I here concern myself about these modern revelations by faith.
The only lasting favor which the parent may confer upon the child is that of helping the child to help itself.
The greatest of all miracles is faith. This is a wonderful age. It is an age of provable miracles. These are the modern miracles that have impressed me most. The miracle which Edison performed when, after thousands of temporary failures, he wrested from nature the secret by which the sound of the human voice may be recorded on a wax record and reproduced perfectly. That miracle was wrought through Edison's faith. He had no precedent to guide him. No other person had ever performed such a miracle. One of the strange things about this miracle is the fact that Edison began at the very outset to experiment with a rudimentary principle and the mechanical apparatus through which the secret of the talking machine was later revealed. The principle was vibration, and the apparatus was a tube made of wax that revolved on a cylinder which contacted the point of a needle. Nothing but faith could have enabled Edison to have begun so near the source of the secret which he sought, and nothing but faith could have given him the persistence to stick to his experiments through more than 10,000 failures. It was faith which enabled Edison to concentrate his mind upon the task, which led him through many thousand failures before he created the incandescent lamp, with which he harnessed the energy known as electricity and made it serve to light the world. It was faith which prompted Edison to continue his experiments with the moving picture machine until he made it actually perform the miracle which he must have seen through his own imagination before he even began. It was faith that sustained the Wright brothers through the years of hazardous experiments before they conquered the air and created a machine that excels both in speed and endurance, the swiftest bird of the air. It was faith that prompted Christopher Columbus to set sail on an uncharted sea in search of a land that, as far as he was concerned, existed nowhere except in his own imagination. Considering the frailties of the little sailing vessels in which he embarked on that momentous voyage, his faith must have been of that variety which enables a person to see the object of his labor already attained before he begins it. It was faith that inspired Copernicus to see that portion of a universe which human eyes had never beheld, and at a time in the history of the world when such revelations as those which he wrought through his faith and his crude mechanical equipment might mean his destruction at the hand of his contemporaries, who believed there were no stars excepting those within range of the human eyes. It was his faith in a cause that enabled Mahatma Gandhi of India to blend into a single mass the minds of more than 200 million of his countrymen, every individual of whom would do Gandhi's bidding even though it meant immediate death. No other influence, excepting faith, could have performed this miracle. Because he has a mind that is capable of sustained faith, Gandhi wields this power passively. Gandhi has proved that faith can accomplish that which trained soldiers and money and implements of warfare cannot achieve. It was faith that cut the shackles of limitation from the mind of Professor Einstein and revealed to him mathematical principles that the world had not even suspected to exist. No fear-bound mind could have uncovered such a miracle. It was faith which sustained our own beloved Washington and drove him on to victory in opposition to vastly superior physical forces, a form of faith which was born of his love for freedom for mankind. The profound principle known as faith is as available to you as it ever was to any human being who has passed this way. If your world is one of limitation, misery, and want, it is because you have not been quickened to the realization that you have in your own mind a laboratory that is equipped to engender the power of faith. If we may judge the possibilities of the future by the achievements of the past, the miracles remaining to be uncovered are vastly greater in number and nature than those that have been revealed in the past. It is not yet revealed what our destiny may be. This is an age of revelation. Those who believe that the power of revelation passed away with the superstition and ignorance which prevailed a few hundred years ago have but little comprehension of our modern history. Men like Watt, Whitney, Bell, Howe, Steinmetz, Edison, the Wright brothers, Lee DeForest, Henry Ford, Simon Lake, Arthur Nash, Einstein, and Gandhi are all miracle men. They have removed the horizons of men's minds and discovered unto us new worlds. Ours is a day of miracles, and this is an age of faith. The world is passing through an experience that will call for many forms of readjustment of human relationships. The real leadership during this period will be found among those who have great capacity for faith. There will be no place in the program of the immediate future for the weaklings and for those who still believe that miracles belong only in the age of the dead past or that they are wrapped up in unfathomable mystery. The miracles of the future will be revealed by science. The research carried on in the field of science has already uncovered the approach to revelations incomparably greater than any of the past. Lesson 4. The Habit of Saving. Man is a combination of flesh, bone, blood, hair, and brain cells. These are the building materials out of which he shapes, through the law of habit, his own personality. To advise one to save money without describing how to save would be somewhat like drawing a picture of a horse and writing under it, "This is a horse." It is obvious to all that the saving of money is one of the essentials for success, but the big question uppermost in the minds of the majority of those who do not save is, How can I do it? The saving of money is solely a matter of habit. For this reason, this lesson begins with a brief analysis of the law of habit. It is literally true that man, through the law of habit, shapes his own personality. Through repetition, any act indulged in a few times becomes a habit, and the mind appears to be nothing more than a mass of motivating forces growing out of our daily habits. When once fixed in the mind, a habit voluntarily impels one to action. For example, follow a given route to your daily work or to some other place that you frequently visit, and very soon the habit has been formed, and your mind will lead you over that route without thought on your part. Moreover, if you start out with the intention of traveling in another direction without keeping the thought of the change in routes constantly in mind, you will find yourself following the old route. Public speakers have found that the telling over and over again of a story, which may be based upon pure fiction, brings into play the law of habit, and very soon they forget whether the story is true or not. Limitation built through habit. Millions of people go through life in poverty and want because they have made destructive use of the law of habit. Not understanding either the law of habit or the law of attraction through which like attracts like, those who remain in poverty seldom realize that they are where they are as a result of their own acts. Fix in your mind the thought that your ability is limited to a given earning capacity and you will never earn more than that, because the law of habit will set up a definite limitation of the amount you can earn. Your subconscious mind will accept this limitation, and very soon you will feel yourself slipping, until finally you will become so hedged in by the fear of poverty, one of the six basic fears, that opportunity will no longer knock at your door. Your doom will be sealed, your fate fixed. Formation of the habit of saving does not mean that you shall limit your earning capacity. It means just the opposite, that you shall apply this law so that it not only conserves that which you earn in a systematic manner, but it also places you in the way of greater opportunity and gives you the vision, the self-confidence, the imagination, the enthusiasm, the initiative, and leadership actually to increase your earning capacity. Stating this great law in another way, when you thoroughly understand the law of habit, you may ensure yourself success in the great game of money-making by playing both ends of that game against the middle. You proceed in this manner. First, through the law of definite chief aim, you set up in your mind an accurate, definite description of that which you want, including the amount of money you intend to earn. Your subconscious mind takes over this picture which you have created and uses it as a blueprint, chart, or map by which to mold your thoughts and actions into practical plans for attaining the object of your chief aim or purpose. Through the law of habit, you keep the object of your definite chief aim fixed in your mind in the manner described in Lesson 2, until it becomes firmly and permanently implanted there. This practice will destroy the poverty consciousness and set up in its place a prosperity consciousness. You will actually begin to demand prosperity. You will begin to expect it. You will begin to prepare yourself to receive it and to use it wisely, thus paving the way or setting the stage for the development of the habit of saving. Second, having in this manner increased your earning power, you will make further use of the law of habit by provision in your written statement of your definite chief aim for saving a definite proportion of all the money you earn. Therefore, as your earnings increase, your savings will likewise increase in proportion. By ever urging yourself on and demanding of yourself increased earning power on the one hand, and by systematically laying aside a definite amount of all your earnings on the other hand, you will soon reach the point at which you have removed all imaginary limitations from your own mind, and you will then be well started on the road toward financial independence. Nothing could be more practical or more easily accomplished than this. Reverse the operation of the law of habit by setting up in your mind the fear of poverty, and very soon this fear will reduce your earning capacity until you will barely be able to earn sufficient money to take care of your actual necessities. The publishers of newspapers could create a panic in a week's time by filling their columns with news items concerning the actual business failures of the country, despite the fact that but few businesses, compared to the total number in existence, actually fail. The so-called crime waves are very largely the products of sensational journalism. A single murder case, when exploited by the newspapers of the country through scare headlines, is sufficient to start a regular wave of similar crimes in various localities. We are the victims of our habits, no matter who we are or what may be our life calling. Any idea that is deliberately fixed in the mind, or any idea that is permitted to set itself up in the mind as the result of suggestion, environment, the influence of associates, etc., is sure to cause us to indulge in acts which conform to the nature of the idea. Form the habit of thinking and talking of prosperity and abundance, and very soon material evidence of these will begin to manifest itself in the nature of wider opportunity and new and unexpected opportunity. Like attracts like. If you are in business and have formed the habit of talking and thinking about business being bad, business will be bad. One pessimist, providing he is permitted to continue his destructive influence long enough, can destroy the work of half a dozen competent people, and he will do it by setting adrift in the minds of his associates the thought of poverty and failure. Don't be this type of man or woman. One of the most successful bankers in the state of Illinois has this sign hanging in his private office. We talk and think only of abundance here. If you have a tale of woe, please keep it, as we do not want it. No business firm wants the services of a pessimist, and those who understand the law of attraction and the law of habit will no more tolerate the pessimist than they would permit a burglar to roam around their place of business, for the reason that one such person will destroy the usefulness of those around him. In tens of thousands of homes, the general topic of conversation is poverty and want, and that is just what they are getting. They think of poverty, they talk of poverty, they accept poverty as their lot in life. They reason that because their ancestors were poor before them, they also must remain poor. The poverty consciousness is formed as the result of the habit of thinking of and fearing poverty. Lo, the thing I had feared has come upon me.
You are a human magnet, and you are constantly attracting to you people whose characters harmonize with your own.
The slavery of debt. Debt is a merciless master, a fatal enemy of the savings habit. Poverty alone is sufficient to kill off ambition, destroy self-confidence, and destroy hope. But add to it the burden of debt, and all who are victims of these two cruel taskmasters are practically doomed to failure. No one can do his best work. No one can find self-expression in terms that command respect. No one can either create or carry out a definite purpose in life with heavy debt hanging over his or her head. Someone bound in the slavery of debt is just as helpless as the slave who is bound by ignorance or by actual chains. I have a very close friend whose income is $1,000 a month. His wife loves society and tries to make a $20,000 showing on a $12,000 income, with the result that this fellow is usually about $8,000 in debt. Every member of his family has the spending habit, having acquired this from the mother. The children, two girls and one boy, are now the age when they are thinking of going to college, but this is impossible because of the father's debts. The result is dissension between the father and his children, which makes the entire family unhappy and miserable. It is a terrible thing even to think of going through life like a prisoner in chains, bound down and owned by someone else on account of debts. The accumulation of debts is a habit. It starts in a small way and grows to enormous proportions slowly, step by step, until finally it takes charge of one's very soul. Thousands of young people start their married lives with unnecessary debts hanging over their heads and never manage to get out from under the load. After the novelty of marriage begins to wear off, the married couple begins to feel the embarrassment of want, and this feeling grows until it leads oftentimes to open dissatisfaction with one another and eventually to the divorce court. People who are bound by the slavery of debt have no time or inclination to set up or work out ideals, with the result that they drift downward with time until they eventually begin to set up limitations in their own minds, and by these they hedge themselves behind prison walls of fear and doubt, from which they never escape. No sacrifice is too great to avoid the misery of debt. Think of what you owe yourself and those who are dependent on you, and resolve to be no man's debtor, is the advice of one very successful man whose early chances were destroyed by debt. This man came to himself soon enough to throw off the habit of buying that which he did not need and eventually worked his way out of slavery. Most of those who develop the habit of debt will not be so fortunate as to come to their senses in time to save themselves, because debt is something like quicksand, in that it has a tendency to draw its victims deeper and deeper into the mire. The fear of poverty is one of the most destructive of the six basic fears described in Lesson 3. The person who becomes hopelessly in debt is seized with his poverty fear, his ambition and self-confidence become paralyzed, and they sink gradually into oblivion. There are two classes of debts, and these are so different in nature that they deserve to be here described as follows. Debts incurred for luxuries that become a dead loss. Debts incurred in the course of professional or business trading, which represent service or merchandise that can be converted back into assets. The first class of debts is the one to be avoided. The second class may be indulged in, providing the one incurring the debts uses judgment and does not go beyond the bounds of reasonable limitation. The moment one buys beyond his or her limitations, that person enters the realm of speculation, and speculation swallows more of its victims than it enriches. Practically all people who live beyond their means are tempted to speculate with the hope that they may recoup at a single turn of the wheel of fortune, so to speak, their entire indebtedness. The wheel generally stops at the wrong place, and far from finding themselves out of debt, such people as indulge in speculation are bound more closely as slaves of debt. The fear of poverty breaks down the willpower of its victims, and they then find themselves unable to restore their lost fortunes. And what is still more sad, they lose all ambition to extricate themselves from the slavery of debt. In wartime, millions of men face combat without flinching, knowing that death might overtake them at any moment. Those same men, when facing the fear of poverty, often cringe and out of sheer desperation, which paralyzes their reason, sometimes commit suicide. The person who is free from debt may whip poverty and achieve outstanding financial success, but if bound by debt, such achievement is but a remote possibility and never a probability. Fear of poverty is a negative, destructive state of mind. Moreover, one negative state of mind has a tendency to attract other similar states of mind. For example, the fear of poverty may attract the fear of ill health, and these two may attract the fear of old age, so that the victim finds himself poverty-stricken, in ill health, and actually growing old long before the time when he should begin to show the signs of old age. Millions of untimely, nameless graves have been filled by this cruel state of mind known as the fear of poverty. Less than a dozen years ago, a young man held a responsible position with the City National Bank of New York City. Through living beyond his income, he contracted a large amount of debts which caused him to worry until his destructive habit began to show up in his work, and he was dismissed from the bank's service. He secured another position at less money, but his creditors embarrassed him so that he decided to resign and go away into another city where he hoped to escape them until he had accumulated enough money to pay off his indebtedness. Creditors have a way of tracing debtors, so very soon they were close upon the heels of this young man, whose employer found out about his indebtedness and dismissed him from his position. He then searched in vain for employment for 2 months. One cold night, he went to the top of one of the tall buildings on Broadway and jumped off. Debt had claimed another victim.
As you hear Hill's comments about debt and poverty, the stories may seem melodramatic and you may feel that they don't bear much relationship to conditions in your world. People's sense of responsibility and personal obligation has changed, and financial debt no longer has the taint about it that it had in Hill's day. After all, the America Hill was writing about was before the crash of 1929 and the Great Depression that followed. It was before the modern stock market, antitrust laws, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Reserve, well before credit cards and light years before e-commerce and dot-com billionaires. The times have indeed changed, but the changing social mores have not altered the basic principle of success. The tales that Hill tells may be from another era, but, as was stated earlier, the philosophy those stories convey has made more millionaires than any other philosophy. Those stories inspired people to succeed during the Great Depression, through World War II, and they were the touchstone for many who made America boom during the 50s and the 60s. It was those same stories and the philosophy behind them that made some of the most successful entrepreneurs of the baby boom generation. And for those who look past the words and learn the lessons, it will be the making of the new millennium millionaires.
Master the fear of poverty. To whip the fear of poverty, one must take two very definite steps, providing one is in debt. First, quit the habit of buying on credit, and follow this by gradually paying off the debts that you have already incurred. Being free from the worry of indebtedness, you are ready to revamp the habits of your mind and redirect your course toward prosperity. Adopt, as a part of your definite chief aim, the habit of saving a regular proportion of your income, even if this be no more than a penny a day. Very soon, this habit will begin to lay hold of your mind and you will actually get joy out of saving. Any habit may be discontinued by building in its place some other and more desirable habit. The spending habit must be replaced by the saving habit, by all who attain financial independence. Merely to discontinue an undesirable habit is not enough, as such habits have a tendency to reappear unless the place they formerly occupied in the mind is filled by some other habit of a different nature. The discontinuance of a habit leaves a hole in the mind, and this hole must be filled up with some other form of habit, or the old one will return and claim its place. Throughout this course, many psychological formulas which the student has been requested to memorize and practice have been described. You will find such a formula in Lesson 3, the object of which is to develop self-confidence. These formulas may be assimilated so they become a part of your mental machinery through the law of habit if you will follow the instructions for their use which accompany each of them.
Who told you it couldn't be done? And what great achievement has he to his credit that entitles him to use the word impossible so freely?
It is assumed that you are striving to attain financial independence. The accumulation of money is not difficult after you have once mastered the fear of poverty and developed in its place the habit of saving. I would be greatly disappointed to know that any student of the course got the impression from anything in this or any of the other lessons that success is measured by dollars alone. However, money does represent an important factor in success, and it must be given its proper value in any philosophy intended to help people in becoming useful, happy, and prosperous. The cold, cruel, relentless truth is that in this age of materialism, a person is no more than so many grains of sand which may be blown helter-skelter by every stray wind of circumstance, unless entrenched behind the power of money. Genius may offer many rewards to those who possess it, but the fact still remains that genius without money with which to give it expression is but an empty, skeleton-like honor. The person without money is at the mercy of the person who has it. And this goes regardless of the amount of ability one may possess or one's training, native genius, or natural gifts. There is no escape from the fact that people will weigh you very largely in the light of bank balances, no matter who you are or what you can do. The first question that arises in the minds of most people when they meet a stranger is, how much money has he? If he has money, he is welcomed into homes and business opportunities are thrown his way. All sorts of attention are lavished upon him. He is a prince, and as such is entitled to the best of the land. But if his shoes are run down at the heels, his clothes are not pressed, his collar is dirty, and he shows plainly the signs of impoverished finances, woe be his lot. For the passing crowd will step on his toes and blow the smoke of disrespect in his face. These are not pretty statements, but they have one virtue. They are true. This tendency to judge people by the money they have or their power to control money is not confined to any one class of people. We all have a touch of it, whether we recognize the fact or not.
Every failure, every adversity, every heartache may be a blessing in disguise, providing it softens the animal portion of our nature.
Thomas A. Edison is one of the best known and most respected inventors in the world, yet it is no misstatement of facts to say that he would have remained a practically unknown, obscure personage had he not followed the habit of conserving his resources and shown his ability to save money. Henry Ford would never have got to first base with his horseless carriage had he not developed quite early in life the habit of saving. Moreover, had Mr. Ford not conserved his resources and hedged himself behind their power, he would have been swallowed up by his competitors or those who covetously desired to take his business away from him long, long years ago. Many of us have gone a very long way toward success only to stumble and fall, never again to rise, because of lack of money in times of emergency. The mortality rate in business each year due to lack of reserve capital for emergencies is stupendous. To this one cause are due more of the business failures than to all other causes combined. Reserve funds are essential in the successful operation of business. Likewise, savings accounts are essential to success on the part of individuals. Without a savings fund, the individual suffers in two ways. First, by inability to seize opportunities that come only to the person with some ready cash, and second, by embarrassment due to some unexpected emergency calling for cash. It might be said also that the individual suffers in still a third respect by not developing the habit of saving through lack of certain other qualities essential for success, which grow out of the practice of the habit of saving. The nickels, dimes, and pennies that the average person allows to slip through his fingers would, if systematically saved and properly put to work, eventually bring financial independence.
The mathematics of savings and compound interest are astounding. Let's say you invest your money at a modest 7%, saving only $25 a month, or 83 cents a day, for 10 years. A total investment of $3,000 will grow to $5,000. Save $50 a month or $1.66 a day, and your overall investment of $6,000 over 10 years becomes $10,000, a profit of $4,000.
The making and saving of money is a science, yet the rules by which money is accumulated are so simple that anyone may follow them. The main prerequisite is a willingness to subordinate the present to the future by eliminating unnecessary expenditures for luxuries. A young man who was earning only $20 a week as a chauffeur for a prominent New York banker was induced by his employer to keep an accurate account of every cent he spent for 1 week. The following is an itemized list of his expenses. Cigarettes, 75 cents. Chewing gum, 30 cents. Soda fountain, $1.80. Cigars for associates, $1.50. Moving picture show, $1. Shaves, including tips, $1.60. Newspaper, daily and Sunday, 22 cents. Shoe shines, 30 cents, for a total of $7.47. Add to that room and board, $12, and his money on hand was 53 cents. These figures tell a tragic story which might as well apply to thousands of other people as to the young man who kept this account. His actual savings out of $20 were only 53 cents. He spent $7.47 for items, every one of which could have been greatly reduced and most of which could have been eliminated entirely. The young man in question was 21 years old at the time he kept this expense account. By the time he reached the age of 31 years, he could have had a substantial amount in the bank had he saved just $25 a month, and this saving would have brought him many opportunities that would have led directly to financial independence. Some who are short-sighted pseudo-philosophers are fond of pointing to the fact that no one can become rich merely by saving a few dollars a week. This may be true enough as far as the reasoning goes, which is not very far, but the other side of the story is that the saving of even a small sum of money places one in a position where oftentimes this small sum may still enable one to take advantage of business opportunities which lead directly and quite rapidly to financial independence. There are published tables that show what a savings of $5 a month will amount to at the end of 10 years. Find such a table. Copy it and paste it on your mirror where it will stare you in the face every morning when you get up and every night as you retire, providing you have not already acquired the habit of systematic saving of money. This table should be reproduced in letters and figures an inch tall and placed on the walls of every public school throughout the land, where it might serve as a constant reminder to all school children of the value of the savings habit.
A modern example would look something like this. Let us consider the example of Terry, a 26-year-old professional who is earning the very solid amount of $36,000 a year. Terry's monthly financial picture is as follows. Income, $3,000. Outgo, taxes, $900. Food, $200. Rent and bills, $750. Car payment, $200. Car insurance, $100. Gas, $100. New clothes, $150. Credit card bills, $150. Student loan, $200. Spending money, $250. Total outgo, $3,000. Terry is saving nothing. It seems impossible with a car and an apartment and a professional wardrobe to keep up, let alone a college loan and a big credit card debt, which is how Terry pays for things like birthday gifts, vacations, car repairs, and new stereo equipment. That $250 spending money vanishes on lunches, dinners out, soap and shampoo, and other little things. How could Terry ever get ahead? Terry has made some poor choices. The down payment on the new car lease emptied his savings account, and car insurance is steep. A good appearance can be important to success, but Terry has long since established a good basic wardrobe. Worse, with a credit card balance of more than $4,000, Terry is paying more than $600 each year in interest, over $50 a month. A cheaper apartment alone would provide enough money to pay off half the credit card debt in a year, saving another $300. The car lease is, unfortunately, an obligation Terry is locked into for 2 years, at the end of which time he will have to take out a new lease or purchase the car for several thousand dollars. Terry decides to bite the bullet and moves into a cheaper apartment, freeing up $200. Half of that goes to credit card bills, and the remainder is used to pay cash for purchases that otherwise would have been charged. Additionally, Terry decides to set aside $20 each week. Not a large amount, but for Terry, an important beginning. At the end of a year, Terry will be only $1,200 in debt to credit card companies and able to retire that debt completely in 6 months more. At the end of that same year, Terry will have over $1,000 in the bank. After the liberating moment when the last credit card bill is paid, there will be an extra $250 each month. But instead of spending that newly available cash, Terry will be in the grip of the saving habit and will devote all of it to savings, socking away $4,040 over the next 12 months. Assuming the continuance of that annual savings of $4,040, there will be more than $10,500 in the bank by Terry's 30th birthday. Assuming just 3% growth and the annual savings contribution, Terry will reach the age of 40 with more than $55,000. Having a healthy nest egg to fall back on is a great antidote to the fear of poverty, making it much easier to develop the self-confidence you need to pursue your definite chief aim. How much easier would it be for you to take a risk if you knew that you had $55,000 backing you up?